And welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Marlboro's most Christmassy work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord, here to talk about Crossed with Silver, 19.7 and 19.8. Let's start with 19.7, shall we? Verona, two in a row Verona chapters. Starting with a familiar scene, Verona and her dad arguing until something different happens. Brett backs down and displays a nugget of empathy. What? Is this some kind of alternate dimension? Nice, Brett.
It's fetch, Brett. He's a fetch.
Maybe. Maybe Verona has snapped and replaced Brett with with a slightly improved version. Yeah. This is a very weird start to this chapter, isn't it? Because it's like, it is... I mean, the word unsettling is used by Verona in text many, many times in reference to this incident. And that's what it is. It's like unexpected in a way that is not reassuring. It's just kind of leaves you with more questions.
Yeah. So I guess the thing with Brett for me is it's like it's easier for Verona to abandon him if he's, this like puddle of whinging and like nothingness. Like when he has these human moments like this, it's like harder to just abandon him because he's, it's a reminder that he is kind of still a whole human being. And I'm not saying that Verona shouldn't be abandoning him. I still think that's the right idea. But, like, it's harder to do when he has moments like this. And that's, like, the trap that, you know, a lot of abusive people, like, you know, well, abusive relationships sort of fall into is, like, So, like, I think that's why it's unsettling is Verona sees the world where, like, this moment lands with her and she doubles down on it. It makes things worse overall.
No, for sure. It's that little glimmer of hope that is so poisonous, I suppose.
Yeah, and is going to make her feel guilt that she really doesn't, well, she shouldn't have to feel.
Yeah, true.
I think, like, I mean, to speak for us as well, like, you know, it's a good reminder for us that Brett is, like, a fully functioning, well, not fully functioning human, but, like, a, you know, all things aside, kind of a human. Like, and I think it makes sense that this is when this part of Brett comes out because, like, this is when Verona, you know, is really struggling with this pain. And I can sort of see that, like, on the one hand, Brett can relate to that. Like, Brett sees how much she's struggling here and it pushes through his barriers. And he, like, you know, he's been there. He doesn't even lean down to fetch her stuff. He has to sit on the toilet to get it because I think his gut is still a problem. And then, like, also, I think it allows him to lean into, like, the script of being the dad, which is, like, I think whenever we see Brett at his best, it's when, like, things are going back to, like, the white picket fancy dream, and we kind of get the impression he fell off the wagon when that got taken away from him. So it's, like, anything to sort of, like, you know, give him an excuse to play the script of being a good father, he will kind of latch onto it when it's, like, also playing into, like, the sort of sympathy he feels he deserves. It's, it's a weird moment,
it is weird, isn't it? You're right, though. It's the when Brett sees the glimmer of that white picket fence life that he can have, he's able to kind of, lean into it more.
And I think this is the sort of thing he does get it. It's like the seeing her in pain pushes past the layers of crap he's built up, and he genuinely, empathizes with her. I also just think it's funny. I wanted to call out, like, last week we were talking about, like, oh, Verona seems to be doing well. Like, you know, I wonder what's going to sort of be next for her character. Just completely forgot about her fucking hand. Like, I don't remember the last time it was actually referenced in the story, but I totally forgotten how bad her hand was.
Her hand is interesting. I think it will be interesting to see it come into the story. It feels like it's especially relevant with Wild Hunt stuff around, right? Like, it's kind of tinged by winter injury, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was one of our first winterification things that we had to deal with in the story, really, explicitly. And it's also, like, the hope for it actually getting fixed was to do with also, like, the end of the story. Like, the only way she can kind of undo it, I think Guillaume said, was, like, if she manages to spin it so that was the halfway point of the journey. And so, like, you know, that's, like, something Verona might want to try and factor into the final fight against Marisica and Charles. I don't know if that's the route they'll actually go or whatever. It kind of feels like on the list of priorities in that fight, this one's going to be a fair way down the list. But yeah, it's a fun time for it to come back up between the fact that we're more directly going up against the culprits more than ever. And also, yeah, as you said, the Winter Wild Hunt is here.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I think it will be interesting if if the Wild Hunt, I don't know, has things to say about Verona's hand injury. I'm sure they would. So yeah, Jasmine picks up Verona and, you know, proves that she's still top pairing around here, despite what Brett might be trying to do. Although she does maybe put her foot in it.
Yeah. I think she does a bit. You know, it's like we're unsettling in the other direction now because like Brett got slightly better at parenting and Jasmine does slightly worse than normal here. So it's really just a topsy-turvy chapter.
Mm. Yeah. but yeah, Jasmine is great. Obviously, she raises the point that Verona is only getting a very filtered version of normality, which means she's like missing out on formative experiences, which is great. The topic of dating is a prickly topic, but the interesting thing is we see later in this chapter, Verona takes her advice. So like clearly, despite the fact that Verona is a bit snarky about it, she does consider and kind of listen to what Jasmine has to say. So in conclusion, Jasmine didn't put her foot in it. She's just wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think I kind of like agree and disagree with Jasmine on parts of this. Like, I agree with you and Jasmine on the whole, like Jasmine basically makes the best case Verona's ever heard for actually keeping one foot in sort of like Canada above, like, you know, hashtag society. Like, the thing that really gets to Verona is the idea that if she completely enters the magical world, she might end up like Ray or Easton. And she's like, oh, I don't want to do that. But yeah, like, so I think like there is this sort of sense that, yeah, it would behoove Verona to, as much as she's really found her momentum and a happy place here, she does need to kind of, yeah, stay attached to the rest of the world. You can't just completely ignore one of these three parts of the triangle that's defining the three Kennets. The comparison that comes up is Jazz compares it to like nurses and how like some of the hospital staff, she's like, without talking to each other, you just get this weird view of people because you'd only see them as patients. Mm. And I definitely have like had similar thoughts chatting to like particularly my sister who works in a hospital, and you hear the way doctors will talk about like groups of people they only interact with in the hospital and how it leads to this kind of weird like these generalizations and like otherification, especially because doctors are they have to kind of treat patients as not full people, because if you treat every patient as like a full person, then you're going to emotionally burn out really fucking quickly. So there's like this interesting sort of otherification that can happen through that sort of interaction, and I can see that link between what Jasmine's talking about with Verona and that, like, just the idea that like if Verona is only interacting with humans or innocents in the like context of giving them books to help them with their weirdest problems, she's not going to stay in touch with society in like any sort of healthy way.
Yeah, interesting. So do you think that Verona is like, Jasmine is practicing this distance from Verona, or
I think that's the comparison Jasmine brings up for like the bad road Verona could go down, is to be like those doctors or nurses who don't have that full image. And so like it's basically the argument for keeping one foot in society, which I think like, yeah, is this interesting next challenge for Verona, because she has really found her groove and she's got like her happy place now. But there's going to be a balancing act because, you know, as much as we all hate to hear it, you can't just like find what makes you happy and then just like go do that and like not really deal with the rest of the world. Like, I think, you know, you sort of have a civic duty or something to kind of keep your head above water a bit. And that's going to sort of, like, that's a balance that I don't think you ever nail. Like, this is one of those Paley things where it's not like Verona's going to find the balance and then live happily ever after. Like, it's just something you need to watch and maintain as you go. And I think that's going to be interesting to see how she goes with that, because that's usually something Verona hates, is the idea of these like chores that never end.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know. I feel like Verona has gotten better at realizing the ways that she needs to engage with the world, right? Like, you know, her schoolwork, I think, is a prime example of like her finding a way to find a balance and engage in the things that she needs to, in quotes, you know, without doing it in a way that is like really rough for her. So I think she'll get there.
Well, yeah, I think the Verona of two arcs ago wouldn't have been able to really hear this from Jasmine. Like, I think, mm-hmm. like, yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. Like, I think she has come a long way. It's just like, yeah, you know, you need nudges from people like Jasmine to push you in the right direction sometimes. And, you know, she's getting that. She's actually able to hear it and understand it now. Yeah. But I do want to say I do kind of disagree with Jasmine on the whole, like, you need to try dating thing, like, to get to the dating topic very specifically. I was like, I don't see how, like, forcing it is actually going to help. Like, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but if someone sort of tells me I have to do something like that, I'm gonna go in there with a really bad mindset, and I'm not gonna give it a fair chance. And I mean, you know, it kind of becomes a moot point because this thing tanks itself pretty much immediately. But yeah, like, I don't know, it feels like, you know, if Verona, if dating had been an option or whatever, like, it would have come up with Jeremy. Like, it's not like Verona wouldn't have tried. Like, I stand by what I was saying last week, and that I thought it was a good idea for Verona to do this as a not date because it would be a fun experience to hang out. That was obviously wrong, but like, that was my reasoning. I stand by that. I don't agree with Jasmine in the whole you should just try dating argument.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, okay. I do agree with Jasmine here. I kind of get what you're saying though, but I feel like the point that Jasmine makes is well made, and all I'm going to do is make it slightly worse if I no. go along with it. But
yeah,
I don't know. I think exposing yourself to new experiences, even if they're ones that make you uncomfortable, as long as it's not an experience that is actively going to harm you, which is one obviously isn't and wasn't. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's a good thing to try and do.
No, I agree. Like, regularly putting yourself outside of your comfort zone is like a necessary part of being a functioning human being. I guess I think like dating is so. Oh, and I also think, yeah, like Jasmine, as I said, I think Jasmine's right overall that Verona needs to sort of up her touching on Canada Buff style society a bit more and engaging with innocence. I just don't think dating is it. Like, this is the one where it seems like Verona is so clearly and confidently of her own, like, internal feeling like that's not it for me, that like I think Jasmine did a lot better when she pivoted to being like, you know, join clubs and shit. Like, I think Jasmine's overall point of you need to increase your engagement with that side of your life is true, and the other ideas were better. I think it's very specifically the whole you should try dating thing that I was like, I feel like that's not going to be a helpful way to go about this.
I mean, we get to see Verona in this scene shortly, because we jump ahead to her running a market stall. She is being in charge of a market, pitching books to folks, but not really making any sales until one opportunity comes along.
Yeah, and like, I'm so enjoying seeing this like practice, or multiple practices as it were, like evolve alongside Verona. Like, she's got that fun vibe of, you know, when you go to the Sunday markets and there's all these people with their stalls and it's just their passionate like hobby, and they're set up their little stall and they're just trying to get like any little sale they can, and it's always just such a great vibe, and like watching Verona do it with this magical spin is so fun.
It is fun, isn't it? We meet Verona's kind of homemade augury deck here.
Yes.
To me, again, the fact that, I mean, Verona's internal monologue here basically is being like effectively thinking along the lines of my goal is to master multiple practices. And like, it was kind of funny to me. I remember Verona used to keep thinking about how she was falling behind the others. And we were like, no, Verona, you're really strong. And this again, is it like, she's already starting to set up like, well, you know, I'm basically a master in alchemy already, blah, blah, blah. So, like, I mean, I don't think she thinks that, but I think she thinks she's already kind of prepping what are the things that she's going to be a master of. She just goes hard, this Verona, doesn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's that sort of thing where I feel like when you're a teenager, you have these sorts of thoughts of like, yeah, I'm going to be good at this and this and this. And then like Verona feels like she's actually going to fulfill it though. Like she's just, you're right. Like the alchemy, we've already seen her doing some stuff. Obviously like she's going quite hard on this peddling thing right now. And then, yeah, as you said, she just sort of made her own augury deck and like, it's so fun. She's already also using it as this like collector thing where she's like storing the trophies from her good kind of peddling and collecting. One thing that really jumped out to me about this deck of cards is she's like, so she's getting the like good vibes or whatever the price people pay for these books and putting it in the cards. And I was like, the only other times we've seen people do these sorts of diagrams where they're getting the power from things and like arranging it like that is Bristow, Milo, and Thea.
Well, Thea is explicitly referenced. Is it this chapter or the previous chapter? Like the arrangement of things, like
No, it's in the context of this, and like Verona, she mentions Bristow too, and like Milo was someone we also learned was doing it, and I just love how this ties into her whole thing about like taking the bad shitty parts and like bringing the good part of them out. Like she's managed to find this practice which so far we've only seen Bristow, Thea, and Milo do, and actually turn it into something that's cool and good. I like that. That's why it feels like she's going to quickly become so powerful, because yeah, she's mining all the best stuff from these shitty practices.
Yeah, it is cool, isn't it? It does feel much more nice than the other collector things that we've seen. It's interesting. I mean, like, I think it's funny that this vibe, like the kind of thing that Verona is doing here, we are kind of seeing it be set up as a needful things-esque thing. And I'm still a little dubious that there's 100% nice and moral way to do this, but Verona seems to be finding it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll see. Like she means well, at least, which is better than you can seemingly say for most of the peddlers, based on what she's quoted from the textbooks.
Yes, for sure.
I just love this idea of like, the DIY tarot deck, like where you build something with like 10 suits, and we only know what about half the suits are, but the only numbers she's kept are the magical ones. And then she's got like cards that, you know, represent the pillars of humanity and the bad Joker and the good Joker to sort of let out other vibes. Like it's just, it makes me want to sit down and try and do this sort of thing, like in a pack dice campaign, like the build your own augury deck. That's so fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, having a handmade tarot deck, I think would imbue each of the cards with such a richer meaning to you as the person using it, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool. I think it's a really cool way to do it.
Well, especially because she's putting that power into them. So she's got the one that's powered up from the one boy that she sold the book to. And so you can imagine her a few years down the line with the 78 all powered up, and so like not only are they cool and personal, but they're just like, they're so powerful. Like that seems like prime implement material.
For sure it does. The book that Verona thinks this lady would want is The Milk Mouth Reconciliations.
Such a fucking good name.
Letters from a Baby to a Mother. So what do you think is in this book, Elliot? I was kind of picturing, it's like, to me, the vibe that this gave is the lady felt very underappreciated by her husband. And so perhaps having a book of like letters from a baby to a mother, appreciating the work that the mother is putting in would be therapeutic for her.
See, I got the impression it was more like a book that would teach her how to understand the baby, if that makes sense. Like
a translation phrase book.
Yeah, you know, that sort of thing. Like you get for dogs where it's like, this type of wolf means X, this type of yowling means Y. Like, just because I think one of the big things when we first introduced to the lady is, like, Verona says it looks like she wants to punt her baby. Like, she doesn't know why it's crying. And, like, so, yeah, the idea that she'd get this book that would, like, teach her how to communicate with her baby better. Especially, you know, when her aforementioned dipshit husband doesn't seem to be helping. like that just feels like what it would be like to me is a thing to help her with the parenting.
Yeah, perhaps.
Page one, get your husband to pull his weight.
Unfortunately, Verona does not have the book with her and is not able to get it in time before the woman slips away. Oh, well.
Yeah, I mean, something I'm really enjoying with all of these market attempts is, like, as much as, you know, as we were just saying, Verona is really starting to feel like this fucking sorceress in progress. Like, she's got these big plans, she's doing them, she's doing all this really cool shit. But she also still very much has that rookie work in progress vibe. Like, every time she's done one of these markets, she's kind of looking at it and she's like, oh, this is kind of dodgy and this is too new. I need to reinforce that. Like, I'm really enjoying this vibe of, like, she's clearly building a really cool, big, powerful thing, but we are in the early stages and we're seeing, like, the foundations being laid. It's just so fun.
Yeah, it is very fun, isn't it? I found it very fun how frustrated Verona gets. So frustrated that it qualifies as nightmare fuel for Alpi.
Yeah. And again, I feel like that fits into that sort of that rookie vibe. Like, she's just getting started. This was only going to be, like, her second ever proper customer and they got away. And, like I felt that too. You feel that, like, oh God, like, this means so much. Whereas, you know, hopefully, like, 10 years down the track, it'd be like, oh, you know, lost customer. Ah, that sucks. But it matters so much because she's still a rookie and it's just beginning.
Yeah. Verona and Bracken have a pretty fun interaction here. Verona is kind of trying to get Bracken to abandon what he's meant to be doing here, which is, they're meant to be here, like, looking out for the negatives, but Verona just kind of gets obsessed with chasing a card for her trading card game.
Yeah, it's very relatable how she just kind of, like, loses the big picture. And, like, I love how Bracken calls her out and she's like, hey, can you just, like, watch that lady and also watch my stall? And Bracken's like, so you want me to watch the stall and the woman who's currently leaving the visibility of the stall? And Verona's like, yes. And he's like, well, no, that's physically impossible. I can't do it. And she's just not really hearing him. Yeah, I agree. This was a delightful interaction. It's fun. I'm loving seeing Bracken integrate into all of this so smoothly because he's just... He takes zero shit.
Yeah, he is a delight. And then, speaking of delights, Mel arrives with Coma Boy and Appaloosa. Looks-wise, Appaloosa is a match for Verona, but personality-wise, ruh-roh. I don't think so.
Like, you know, in terms of the idea of, like, Verona trying dating or, like, forcing it for a bit or whatever, I feel like this pretty... concretely seals the deal on that just never happening, because this takes all of about 2 seconds for it to be like, well, no, this is nothing, this is going nowhere.
Now the question is, Elliot, does Appaloosa's large penis imbue him with any actual magical powers? Because he kind of seems to indicate that it does, but maybe it's just him being, you know, bragging.
I mean, it's a Undercity person, right? Like, you don't... Yeah. The line could go either way. I think he's minor enough that it probably is just, like... Yeah, he's like that goblin-esque thing of he's leaning into building his whole personality around his dick, which, you know, he's a teenage boy. But, yeah, like, I don't think he's got any special abilities yet. It depends whether he grows into someone like the Bitter Street Witch in the old bodies, I think. Or the Family Man.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe he'll become a main character and we'll get to see all of his cool powers soon enough. we also here get a little teaser that Avery's going to go speak to the market that Gilkey was last seen at. So maybe Avery will finally find out what happened to Gilkey, which will be very fun.
Yeah, if she knows about this market, there's a chance she already does. Like, and maybe she just got filled in off screen.
Last we heard of it, she had said... at the Halloween party that she had hoped that Gilkey might show up, right?
Yeah, but it's like Christmas now.
Yeah.
Like, that was that was pre 2 month time skip.
Fair enough. I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know. I guess it's just one of those things where, like, maybe I'm coming at this a bit, like, from out of the story, but metatextually I'm kind of like, we know about it. It kind of, I don't necessarily see the reason to continue holding that out of Avery's POV.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm missing something. Yeah. I also wanted to point out, and I don't know if, like, so obviously Appaloosa's whole thing is he's a horse boy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jeremy left Verona to get with a horse girl. And I was like,
interesting.
As this was happening, I was like, is this Mal, like, is, like, I was like, is Mal doing this on purpose? Because I was like, frankly, that's a pretty funny prank.
I don't think so. It doesn't seem like us doing
it. Like, I'm just, if Mal turned around and said, oh, see, but I thought you'd want to go with a horse boy to make up for Jeremy going with a horse girl, I would have thought that was pretty funny. I still, you know, it doesn't change anything. Verona still absolutely shouldn't go on this date or whatever, but like,
yeah,
that's a funny bit.
Mm. Yeah, no, that is good. That is a good catch. So yeah, Lucy, Verona, and a gang of others head to find the Negateers, and they find one who escapes and one who doesn't.
Yeah, and I really love this immediate cut from in the market. It ends with Verona seeing Jabba and the way they're planning on using him. She's like, oh, that leads me to an idea. And I was like, oh, God, let me add this to my list of obscure facts we know about Verona's grand master plan, because apparently Jabba fits in now. And then I ended up having to delete it immediately because it's actually a cut straight to this idea that she has, like, you know, immediately. And I love that because we obviously had that other chapter where we were talking so much about how we saw Verona's idea grow from infancy to, like, being realized. And here we just jump cut to it immediately. And I feel like that's what it was like for Liz and Charles, presumably. Like, Verona just goes from 0 to 100 in, like, you know, oh, I might use Jabba. And then she's just like, well, I'm going to use him right fucking now. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that using Jabba to find out somebody who's pretending to be a human trick, which they used on, it was Bridge, right? They used it to find Bridge a while ago. Yeah. The return of Jabba as a cool trick. Let's talk about this boy that they corner on the roof, who eventually throws himself off the roof and into the abyss, perhaps? Who knows?
I got abyss vibes, especially because he kept talking about how shit his practice was, and yes, all we hear from the abyss is that people thought it was hell, so it was like, I assume that's what he's doing.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, from this conversation and what we'll get into next chapter, these poor kids are so fucked. Like, what? They're in such a bad situation that they seem to not really just not have a grasp of.
Yeah, especially because, like, the thing that really got me is, so they, you know, and Lucy discusses this in a bit later, these kids are very specifically being established as the culprit equivalent of the Kenneteers.
Yes.
And what's weird to me about that is that they're having their specialties forced on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, you know, it's not surprising that Miss let the Kenneteers find their own specialties and that she's better because she's not a piece of shit. But isn't Charles's whole thing that he didn't want roles, like, forced onto people that they couldn't escape?
Wait. Elliot, are you trying to say Charles is a hypocrite? No.
But he's not usually a hypocrite like this. Like, this is like, there has to be,
like, he kind of is.
There has to be more to this, because I don't see how even Charles can reconcile his whole shtick and then locking kids into a practice specialty that they don't want to do. Like, there has to be another layer to understanding these kids that we don't have yet, because even he's not that hypocritical.
I don't know. I looking at this, it was kind of like, oh, so they just, you know, Marcy wanted these Kenneteers around to be used originally, right? And now they've made the Negateers, which are effectively like take two at the same concept. Children that can be used, manipulated, and then discarded. And so, great, you know?
Yeah, it reminds me of way back in the day when Marcy was like, oh, you know, I thought about selling you guys to the fairy markets for a bit of fun in the middle. And like, part of me is like, fuck, is she going to sell the Negateers out to the Wild Hunt at some point for shits and gigs?
Maybe.
Hopefully now that she's a blood goddess, she's not as behooven to those sorts of impulses, but who knows? I mean, like, you're right, that comparison to what the Kenneteers were sort of meant to be according to non-Miss people in Kennet is a really fun comparison, because like, we first found out about these guys from Kennet's perspective with Father Grobar escaping, and we learn here that that was a mistake, and that is kind of hilarious, because I remember there was a whole thing, I think it was in early arc 4, where the Kenneteers stuffed up at that party, and Matt was like, honestly, all of us are kind of relieved that you done goofed, because we were starting to get worried that you were like too competent and we wanted idiot kids who would make mistakes. And so part of me's like, yeah, like, how much with Father Grobar escaping, we're like, yeah, Charles and Marcy, like, oh good, they're still idiots.
Great, they're idiots that we can manipulate. Yeah.
Well, like, yeah, just the comparisons. I think something we're going to be talking about a lot, especially in this Lucy chapter coming up, is like how much fun it is to compare these nine Negateers to who the Caneteers were at the start of the story.
I think we'll get to that more in our next chapter, though. Yeah. But yeah. So yeah, while interrogating one kid, Lucy and Verona are interrupted by the Wild Hunt, who have finally arrived, and they're terrifying.
This, yeah, I mean, this is always my favorite part of Wild Bow stories. Like, we could just be doing the Negateers, and that would be enough, but it's like, no, let's throw the Wild Hunt in here, too. Let's just let's get fucking wild with it. It up. I love how the Wild Hunt's, like, whole shtick is really, it's definitely working on me as a reader. Like, I've already slotted them in my head as this, like, natural, unstoppable force. Like, like a blizzard that swept into town, which is, like, imagery I think they directly conjure when they first appear here. But there's, like, there's this sense to them that, like, there's even less of a point to fighting them than there is Charles or Massa. Yeah. Like, they're just here. They've got their bounds that they operate in, and it's just best to stay out of their way. It's such a terrifying and new dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that there's like tens of them in town.
Although
I don't know, like a lot.
I mean, the other thing with glamour as a factor, it could just be four of them. It could just
be like three. You don't know, right? But they really do feel completely overpowering and not like, it's set up as, this is not a fight that you can win. This is just a force that you have to try and avoid or aim at, at Marcy, I guess, other than yourself.
Or hope that they just leave eventually. Yeah. Like they snoop around for a bit and just hope they don't fuck your shit up too much.
Yeah. In 19.8, we're in Lucy's head. Lucy and Verona are continuing their interrogation of Harry, this kid that they found, before they carry her out of the school. Literally. I think these two are, Lucy and Verona, are very reasonable here. Like, I feel like they're being overly nice to these Negateers, which, I guess makes sense because of the Negateers clearly not knowing what situation they found themselves in. But there is almost like a good cop, bad cop dynamic in this start of this chapter, which is very fun.
Yeah, you're right. Lucy and Verona sort of naturally slot into, Lucy's a little bit harsher and Verona is like trying to be your friend. And it's, I think it works because it's so natural. But yeah, I mean, to touch on what you were saying about how reasonable the Caneteers are being, I think that's what I really love about this dynamic is you can kind of transpose this onto the chats they've had, particularly with like Elizabeth Driscoll, we know the Caneteers are being fair and reasonable, but you can see how the Negateers can't see that. Like, you could see how they might, like, if they've heard how awful or terrible the Caneteers are and they're going to try and manipulate them or whatever, you can see how, from the other perspective, they must sound like Liz did when she was trying to talk to the Caneteers. And like, because Elizabeth very much was like, I'm being fair and reasonable. I'm just trying to make this work for everyone. So just let Massa invade you a little bit and we can work some stuff out and it'll be fine. And she totally wasn't being reasonable, but she thought she was. And like, I could see why the Negateers would think that's the Caneteer vibe right here. And that's so fun.
It is very fun.
Because they brought Jabba and three of the dog tags, which is like,
yes,
like an intentionally scary squad that's even sort of leaning into like some, you know, police imagery, as you mentioned, which you know, is stuff that the Caneteers have floated around for quite a while.
I don't know, I think they're being very reasonable in this situation, to be honest, given what happened with Father Gobeck.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I'm 100% on the Caneteers side, but I love that I can see why the Negateers would see this as them being like Elizabeth or something. Oh, that's what's fun. I mean, is
it's,
like,
it's worrying.
Yeah,
if you're
they are being fair, but it's so fun to see how it doesn't look that way from the other side. I also love, like, as you talked about, like Lucy and Verona's dynamic here a bit. I love that. Because what we see here at the start is that like they definitely disagree on a lot of stuff, but they very quickly constantly work through it. Like, you know, one of them will say something, the other one will be like, oh, you know, I think X instead. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay. And like they bounce ideas off each other and like problem solve cooperatively.
Mm.
And this is like, there's even a moment where Verona gives Lucy some of her final emergency Darkfall glamour, which is like, you can tell Verona wouldn't want to do that unless she trusted Lucy that this was like a serious good idea. And I just like it's really fun seeing them in action being so in sync here, because we're going to get to directly contrast that to the Negateer group that we're about to meet in a bit and see how they're like a bickering mess. And like Lucy brings that up and talks about what a mess they are. But I love that we really feel that, because it's contrasted with how Lucy and Verona operate so effectively at the start here.
Yeah, you're right. The Negateers are, I mean, they're so, I don't know, they're so at each other's throats the whole time.
Yeah, like if one of the Negateers asked the other one for some of their last Darkfall glamour, I don't think it would have been a like, are you sure you need it? Yes, okay, then conversation. It would have been a lot longer and a lot stupider.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I love that, because that so suits the culprits. Like, you know, I think we already touched on this idea. Like, this is what Marcy did to the Kennedys. She made them not in sync, and they've sort of recovered from that. But I love how, you know, Marcy's presumably had a hand in setting up these dipshits, and she's done it again. And whenever we see Charles and Edith and Marcy in a room, they're bickering idiots like this. So of course their Kennedys are too.
This is what their Kennedys would turn out like. Yeah. 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 God. But yeah, so Lucy decides to keep spying on them instead of taking Harry out of here. And the Negateers meet up and talk amongst themselves and with their benefactors as well. And yeah, I mean, they're so fucked. They're clearly so out of their depth. They're in trouble.
Yeah, and again, I'm loving this view from the other side of the window. Like, this is how Nicolette and co saw the Kenneteers at the start of the story, and it's so fun seeing these kids who have been roped in by bad evil powers who are giving, and it's like, no, you don't understand. They're the bad others. Stop using their power. It's bad. We, the existing system in Kennet, are the good guys, and you must listen to us. Like, it's just, it's so fun. And like the banter here amongst the Negateers feels so similar to early story stuff the Kenneteers would talk about. Like, it's more toxic, as yes, mentioned, but like
it feels meaner, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's that same like, oh, can we talk to so and so? Oh, I don't know. Like, and like discussing what's possible, who to talk to. Like, it's all the same shit the Kenneteers used to do with the first few arcs of the story. It's just so fun seeing this dark, twisted version of the same thing from the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is delightful. So much bickering. So what do you think all their specialties are? So I feel like there's only one of them that seems to pick up on the fact that the Wild Hunt is here. So I feel like that's a hint that I think it was Nomi, maybe, was potentially Fae related.
Wait, hold on. I've been keeping a list of all their names and what we know about them. It was... No, apparently I didn't write that down. I think it was Kirilin or Nomi who noticed them. But yeah, I guess it would make sense that one of them might be fairy-ish related, given that, you know, Mariska still hasn't fully eradicated that part of herself. I think I saw other people speculating about this too. I was wondering if their teachers are like Charlie's angels, like the Forsworn people that he's...
I think so. I think that's what we had to take from it.
It wouldn't surprise me to learn that some fairy adjacent practitioner got himself or themselves forsworn by a fairy. That feels like a trap that they'd love to set. So
for sure.
Yeah, one of them being Phaedrus. Obviously, yeah. I guess we think the kid from the roof is doing something with the Abyss, just because it sounds like his specialty is shit. I don't know if that's separate from, like, they found that body, the sort of necromancy, whatever they seem to be doing. I don't know if that is abyssal or not, but that could be a different specialty one of them has. Kirilin is mentioned as somebody who would be the point person for dealing with the Ordinary Family, which the Ordinary Family were... One of the things we got introduced to in 18.1, that was that like family where even the legendaries were like, we don't really know what they are. We just locked them up and hoped they'd stop being a problem. So what's funny about that detail is it doesn't even help us know what Kirilin's specialty might be, because nobody knew what the Ordinary Family was.
Yeah. 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 What the fuck? The Ordinary Family is still so fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
I can't wait till we see more of them. I hope we do.
Yeah, I'm so because they were the ones where it was like people just went in and came out as a different self, but nobody could figure out what that meant or why it was happening. Like, that's what does that mean? Yeah, that's so it's so fun. So yeah, I think that's pretty much all we know. We've got Adrian is the technomancer, Jonathan Abyssy slash necromancy stuff, maybe necromancy could be something else, and then Kirillin does weird shit. I think that's all we know for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get more of a picture of them as the Kenneteers fight them, yeah, if that happens, which maybe it won't based on the fact they let Harry go.
Yeah, and the warning they get in a bit. We'll get to that when it comes up. Yeah.
So yeah, it turns out all the most villainous lords around here are the ones most actively benefiting the Negateers, which is fun.
Yeah.
Obviously, the evil lords are kind of stand-ins for the Kennet others, with the Negateers being the Kenneteers. Like, you know, Lucy explains
so
this,
good.
And we kind of obviously see it. I love the phone. The moment that we realize it's the phone lord who is who they're about to chat to, and I'm just like, oh fuck, of course it is.
Yeah, and they're getting asked to set up stuff to make it harder to travel through his realm, presumably because he's pissed at the shit Avery just pulled.
Yep.
So that's it. Thank God Lucy found out about that, because we need to keep Avery the fuck away from that domain if she's not going to be able to escape again. And this is so fun because I really had just assumed that they were going to be getting their power just from the four culprits. But the idea that it's actually contracts they've signed with these lords is so fun, particularly because it's just hilarious that the culprits aren't fully tied in, at least, or they're not the only ones. And also, I love this idea that they're contracts that need to be renewed. Like, if these kids or if Charles loses his relationship with the lords, they'll just stop signing the contracts and the kids are out. Whereas Kennet doesn't have that same exit clause, I don't believe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's worrying.
Yeah. I guess knowing that these kids are directly interacting with and working for, in some cases, these lords, it continues to make me really interested in what Charles's final plan for these nine sort of is, because, or soon to be 10, actually, we learned that they're recruiting a 10th. But the Kenneteers were Mrs. Pitch for what practitioners should be, which was like community funded sheriffs, basically. So what, like, Charles has set them up as his version of that. What exactly is he pitching there? Like, you know, these guys are just working for the lords, but is that the final goal? Like, what are these guys designed? What is their role in Charles's weird societal hierarchy that he's building? Do they persecute certain groups? Do they protect certain groups? Like, I'm so curious to see where they fit in his grand scheme, because I don't feel like I get it yet.
I'm not sure either.
It's going to be a dark reflection of Mrs., because he's drawing on this same idea of they make contracts with the lords,
yes,
to work with them. So it's similar, but it's going to be different in some crucial way that makes it shit, because that's what Charles does.
I don't know. I'm sure. I wonder if it's just they want people to manipulate. Like, I don't think it's going to be like, you know, the purpose of the Kenneteers was originally to kind of be the town practitioners, right? I don't know if it's going to be an inversion of that so much as just going to be like more bodies on their side that they can kind of make the Kenneteers feel shit about having to deal with, you know?
I feel like I remember in 18.z Charles, or 18.y maybe it was, Charles very explicitly stating that this was like a part of his plan, where he was setting these kids up to be there
for something,
ambassadors for their vision or whatever it was, like something like that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if Charles wants to change the way that the practice is working, that has to include practitioners, right? So maybe that's
exactly
what these nine are. They're the ambassadors. Yeah.
But what is what? Yeah. What does this look like? Where is this going? I guess is what I still don't have a good picture of. Like, this clearly isn't like the end game. Isn't 10 kids in a school getting taught by forsworn people and wards or whatever shit. Like, there's gonna be an end goal like there was for the Kenneteers, and I'm just so excited to see what it is.
Lucy is at a training session with Guillaume next. Bracken and Mal here too, sorry, Brecken and Mel, being observed by a lot of Winter Fae.
Yeah, good old Oakham is here. Just, I don't think she gets it at all.
No. How good is this lesson? Even more horrifying than usual. The tension of the Winter Fae watching and, you know, us knowing that this means Guillemet has to be his most winterest and be his most annoying and terrible. And Lucy has to be bulletproof, which is obviously the kind of a theme yes. that's been running through this entire chapter. This chapter is so fucking good. I loved it so much.
Yeah, it was like the previous Verona chapter from this week was Verona sort of, now that she's found her groove, coming to terms with, like, as she's growing it, making sure that she's keeping a balance in all the parts of her life. And then this is Lucy chapter where it's very much like, okay, she's trying to juggle how she's perceived by the Winter Court. Yeah, like, as you said, the bulletproofness comes out so, I mean, it's not even a metaphor because it just gets called out by Lucy, like, it's never been more literal, her need to be bulletproof so she can't be judged, than it is right now. Like, the Winter Wild Hunt to me sort of represents this, like, old guard group that are running around and maintaining the status quo and making sure everyone conforms to the standards. Mm. And they're demanding this perfection. And it's like, so of course, fucking that gets targeted at Lucy. Like, it's just, it's, yeah, such a great extension of all of her bulletproof metaphor stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It is great. I think Guillemet does so well in this lesson. Like, this lesson to me was the most, I mean, Lucy feels like she's kind of getting him more and more now, right? And getting, in this lesson at least, a lot of what he's trying to teach her, emphasizing that they're fighting something that is effectively unwinnable. And maybe that if they work together, they'll have some moments of a chance that it might matter. And, you know, representing that some members of their team are terrible and uncoordinated, Runa, so they'll have to kind of cover for them and all that stuff. It's great. It's very fun.
Yeah, and the whole, like, he turns himself into this stand-in for Musa and yes. or Charles. Yeah. And then, yeah, I think the reason that sort of stand-in works great too is because she's got the Wild Hunt watching her, and it does to an extent feel like that is the pressure kind of on Kennet here too, because there is this sort of sense that if Kennet won, like, you know, beat Musa and beat Charles or whatever, but they did it in this dirty way that, you know, somehow takes away from how they won it, then, like, a lot of people will hold that against them. So, and that's the thing Lucy tends to be very conscious of. So there is this idea that, like, she isn't just trying to fight Musa and Charles. She's trying to fight them while everyone's watching so that they can judge her if she does it in a bad way. And so, like, yeah, Guillemet standing in for Musa and Charles, but the Wild Hunt is standing in for, yeah, the rest of the world who will be ready to judge Kennet if they don't win right.
Yeah, you're right. I think there's a lot of great parallels to their situation here. And it's hard for me to know if that's intentional from Guillemet's perspective or just a nice coincidence, but it does feel intentional.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, like, now that we've got Fairy interacting with Fairy, there's going to be so many layers of games going on here. I'm just going to prematurely, like, tap out. Just like, I'm not going to keep up with all the shit Guillemet and the Wild Hunt are doing with each other, because I guarantee there was, like, extra messages Guillemet was communicating to the Wild Hunt and vice versa as all this was going on.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure there was a lot going on here that we didn't get, right? Like, for sure there would have been.
Because this is going to kind of be the thing with the Wild Hunt, right? Is they were apparently sent here by Musa to kind of shake shit up. So yes. You'd think, if that's to be believed, and if they are, like, doing that for Estrella or whatever, they presumably come with a bit of an agenda to cause trouble.
Yeah, I feel like they will cause trouble. They don't need to be given an agenda for that. Like, they're already, like, anything they find that's out of line, it's going to be trouble, right?
Yeah, but I guess, you know, like, you can't rule out the possibility that Guillemet, they'll decide he's doing all right and they want to leave Kennet or whatever. Like, there's just so much shit going on. Like, we don't know where the Wild Hunt are going to land because they're fairy. So I don't know what level they're operating on. And so it's kind of like, this is almost the most terrifying thing about them is, alongside the idea that they could just call in the rest of the Wild Hunt and blow their horn and shit would just get incredibly real, they might also just decide to potentially weigh the ability to help out if you seize it.
Mm. Yeah, I also am kind of worried, like, because surely they're going to have something to say about Marisica, which...
Yeah, well, that's their, like, main target, isn't it? Like, yeah, finding out shit about Marcy.
I feel like if they attack Marisica, the collateral damage is going to be such a bitch for the Kennedys to deal with anyway. Like, it's kind of a lose-lose, right?
I have enough faith in Marisica that I don't think that's going to be a problem while they're here. I'm sure she's fucked off to somewhere. They're not going to find her. But yes, that could be an avenue to kind of, like, I could see Kenna being like, hey, we'll keep you tapped on what we know about Marcy or whatever, like, to get peace with them. But then it's like, yeah, the second you sick them on Marcy, like, the collateral damage is huge. Who knows?
Yeah,
I keep trying to convince myself that actually the Wild Hunt is going to end up being helpful, but that's probably just way too optimistic.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's wishful thinking. It might be. I mean, depends on what happens with Marcy, I guess. But yeah, we also
I have enough faith in Marcy, especially now that she's a goddess, to not be caught out by these guys appearing in town. I'm sure she's got it under control for now.
Yeah.
But they're not going to find her right away. Something will go wrong for her to get found.
But yeah, so Lucy, you know, interprets the message that was being sent to the Negateers, but really to her, which was, you know, back the fuck off. but this does seem to mean that she's now certain that this is a Charles, Liz and Marcy special, basically.
Yeah. And so we're continuing to hurtle towards conflict with the culprits being inevitable, it feels like.
Yes, for sure.
Like, there's no way this peace can maintain. As Lucy mentions, Musa's presumably on his way back at some point to, you know, avoid further punishment. And then, yeah, you know, they can't pull sneakies when Liz and Charles are both nigh omniscient. So, yeah, I mean, I guess we've got to start looking out for these moments of weakness Guillemet was telling us all about. Wait, this is where it starts to, yeah, knock on wood, feel like we're potentially heading towards the finale of the story again, or at least another big climax, because it's like it feels like we're on the trajectory towards fighting with Charles again, which, you know, would be tying threads up, not start adding new ones or whatever. That's a couple of arcs away still, it feels like. Like, I'm not saying we're 10 chapters away from the end, but it's certainly like it feels like we're heading directly towards the next big finale.
Yes, I think so too. But I'm not putting too much stock in that until we know for sure.
Yeah, it still feels like, yeah, there's at least a few arcs before we get there. Like, we got shit to do, but I don't know. I didn't feel that way necessarily as much in, like, arcs 16 and 17, because I was like, well, Musa's not the problem. Like, Charles was not a factor, whereas I can't think of anything this time that makes me think that we aren't, moving directly towards it.
Yeah. So, Lucy is with her mum venting about how many things are piling up, and Jasmine wants to ensure that Lucy doesn't fall too far behind in her life, I suppose.
Yeah. Basically, in both these chapters, we're really seeing Jasmine try to continue to be a parent despite knowing about the magic now.
And Jasmine continues to be the best. She expresses concerns, relates to Lucy, and then supports her and gives her the mothering that she needs. So, again, Jasmine, thumbs up. You're the best.
Yeah, she's doing everything she can to still be a good parent, despite fucking rough that is right now with all the magic and shit going on. I think, like, again, something that Jasmine does quite well here is hit Lucy with, like, a bit of an inconvenient and harsh truth that Lucy doesn't want to hear and wouldn't necessarily be a correct generalization for every kid, but is probably correct in the case of Lucy. Like, this idea of you probably need to figure out what your life looks like 5 to 10 years from now. Like, I don't think every 14-year-old needs to have that sort of plan, but I think Jasmine's right that Lucy probably should be putting more effort into thinking about it. Like, what is she actually fighting for? What does she see as the end goal? Because if you don't have that, then you're just a fighter, and then you're no better than Easton or Rook. Like, you're just somebody who exists to be a war mage. So, yeah, I think this is a fun challenge to lay at Lucy's feet, is like, what are you being bulletproof and fighting for? Like, what do you actually want to achieve with this?
Yeah, I mean, Jasmine's so on top of it, right? Like, Lucy doesn't...
It's a good insight.
Like, she's got it. Yeah, I mean, it's perfect. It's very well done, Jasmine.
And yeah, because it's not the sort of advice every 14-year-old would need, but it's definitely, like, I mean, I guess this is what being the parent of a teenager is, I think, is like hitting them with the shit that they don't necessarily want to hear, but in their case is accurate. Because I wouldn't apply that logic. I wouldn't apply this advice to every 14-year-old, but I would apply it to Lucy. And like a good parent is somebody who can see that that's what Lucy needs, even if she doesn't want to hear it, and tells her anyway.
But yeah, Lucy goes off to have a well-earned nap, and in this nap has a lovely and heartbreaking dream, and we should just move on and not talk about it because I don't want to reflect on it too much.
I mean, this is hilarious though, right?
Oh yeah, it's so funny, Elliot. And that's definitely not something that only a psychopath would say.
But it's like, because Jasmine's like, you know, what are your dreams? What are you aiming for? Yeah. And Lucy goes to sleep, and immediately we see the one that she can't have. Like, this is what she wanted for the first 13 arcs. Is it was like, this is kind of what she was aiming for. And it's just so hilariously awful that it's like, what dreams do you want? And it's like, well, I wanted that one, but I can't fucking have it. And it's like, that is the fucking awful compromise that is Lucy's existence.
Oh God, it makes me wish that there is a way that Lucy can get to this point, but it seems like that's impossible, right? And I don't want to get my hopes up.
There was like this tiny part of me that's like, she wakes up and the dog tag is still like pressing into her chest in this painful way, and I was like, is there a bit of John in there maybe?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, don't be an idiot, Elliot.
But yeah, so Lucy wakes up from this nightmare and hits the books because she can't, you know, she wakes up at midnight and starts studying her law practices, and it's just like, oh my God, tragic.
I do really vibe with Lucy leaning into this like law-based sort of, or knowing all the fundamental laws of the practice. Like, all of these book titles that she's picking up are so clearly like Muss's kind of shit. And this is what we talked about when Verona and her talked about her picking this up a couple of weeks ago. But like, Lucy being aimed with the like rule of law and the practice just feels so like such a perfect extension of how she operates. And I can't wait to see her the next time Muss tries to like call precedent, her hit him with a contradictory one and just like shove it in his face. Especially because he saw something in her in their recent interaction, and I just love it for that to be that she has the same strengths as him, but none of the stupid weaknesses. Like she's muscle gone good. Also, courtroom dramas are awesome, and courtroom dramas are one of the few things we haven't done much of in Pale. So I'm always down for more of it. courtroom drama with the judges, please.
Yeah. I mean, it would be fun for sure.
And I feel like the way that this chapter ends, this is meant to be implying to us that this is sort of Lucy's answer to Jasmine's question. Like her career path at the moment is presumably some sort of magical prosecutor. I was thinking, we've seen that one guy in Thunder Bay who helps practitioners write contracts, which is like something lawyers can kind of do. But like, I don't think we've ever seen like practitioner lawyers. So I don't know what to expect, but I can't wait to see Lucy be like presumably some kind of magical prosecutor or defender.
I don't know exactly what that looks like. We have what's his face from Thunder Bay, right? Who's the? Oh, did you already mention that?
Yeah. But like that was like writing contracts. That's like the basic like bitch lawyer thing.
It's not courtroom law.
Yeah, exactly. That's not the good wife law. That's the boring real life law. I want to see Lucy do the good wife stuff.
Exactly.
And I don't quite know what this looks like outside of hearings with the judges, so I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. But we'll have to see it next time, Elliot, because that's the end of these chapters, of our discussion of these chapters. But it's not the end of the episode because we have a discussion question that we need to get into the answers that we need to review from the past fortnight.
So we asked everyone, which video game character would you summon as another?
And we got a lot of different answers to this, but the one that we got the most, three times in fact, is Harry Dubois two times, but I've put Kim Kitsuragi as my answer, so I'm counting that as a third.
Okay, fair.
Yeah, Disco Elysium. And I mean, genuinely,
if you'd asked me to predict what answer would get the most, it would not have been this. This blew my mind. Not once, yeah. Not twice, but three times that people are putting this answer down.
But I love the idea, like, because, I mean, one, Harry would make a great Familiar, I think, but he's like...
Sorry, what?
Yeah, he would be spectacular as a Familiar. But, like, the idea of this, like, bumbling detective who stumbles his way into situations and is able to kind of navigate them, and also maybe has like spirits that advise him and sometimes give terrible advice. I just think it's great. It's just like, I mean, he effectively is kind of a bit of a other in his own game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think that was what Haunt of the Heron brought up, is that they're like, he's like the perfect person to stick into the midst of a bunch of fairy schemes, because he's just going to bumble his way through it.
Yeah,
and somehow unravel it while just being drunk. Like, it's not quite goblin-esque, but definitely playing in a similar area.
Yes. T-Star would also put Harry from Disco Elysium, also with sidekick Kim Kitsuragi, who would be spectacular. I mean, it's just great. It's a great answer.
I thought it was funny because my biggest takeaway from Tsarwat's answer was when they went through the features of their Harry Dubois from their playthrough and why they'd want him, all I could think was, wow, we had very different playthroughs of this game because their Harry Dubois was very different to mine. And I think that's almost part of the fun of like picking him as an answer, is like you can go like to Tsarwat and say, I want my iteration of Harry Dubois, but it's fun to think about the fact that if you spawned more generally a Harry Dubois, you're going to get this person who reacts completely differently in different circumstances to kind of emulate the huge variance in his character that there can be in the game. Mm-hmm. Like, it might even be more like, you know how Snowdrop, when she was kind of converted to an other, got like a download from Avery. It's like when you summon Harry Dubois, you get the Harry Dubois template that gets some downloads from you as the source.
Mm.
Cause like my, you know, like, Tsarwat was like, oh, you get Kim as an accessory of Harry Dubois because they're inseparable. And it's like, that was not true in my game. Like, Kim got shot and I didn't have him for the second half, and I was glad to be rid of him because he was constantly fucking ruining my vibe.
Yeah, I can't believe that. That's such a thing for you to say.
I hated Kim.
Kim was the best character.
But this is what's fun, is like, there's so many different options for what you get from Harry. It's great.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think having Harry as an other, you would maybe get a personalization, but maybe just kind of get all of them at once.
Yeah. And you're right. Like, I think it was Haunt of the Heron who said Harry's probably already an aware. And like, you get that vibe. He's just got these voices in his head that are presumably rando spirits giving him shit advice.
Yeah. Some other great answers. I really liked Sengachi's answer. Kirby, who is fun from like a recognition from like a power level, but also one very recognizable, which would make him powerful in the practitioner-verse presumably, and also disposition from a disposition perspective, not a kind of a brooding annoying character that you wouldn't actually want to hang around, you know.
Yeah, good point. Because the bad thing about having Harry Dubois is you'd need to work with him. In terms of others that you summon that you can work with, Harry is about the worst case scenario, isn't
he? Yeah, he would be
or at least mine would be.
Yeah,
no, you're right. Because I think like to bring on the recognition thing, like the thing we always hear about technomancy, in fact, Adrian, our new technomancer, brought it up in this chapter too. The weak part of technomancy is because the grooves aren't very laid in yet. It's all kind of weak. So any recognition feels like it's a boon for technomancy. So I think that that's like a key good thing for Kirby.
It
is funny that Sengachi calls him sweet and stuff. I've never actually played any of the Kirby games. So I only know Kirby from Smash Bros. So I have him in my head as this violent little, like, you know, piece of shit, but
he's not violent. If anything, he's ambivalent to the concerns of mere mortals.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm vaguely familiar with some of the memes about how he's like an infinitely powerful god and all that too. But I just, yeah, I don't know. I had this more violent impression of him having not played the actual games.
Yeah. who else did we get? We got a lot of Pokemon responses. Scruza talked about maybe it would be good to use Pokemon as kind of a layer over others to kind of disguise them or amplify elemental abilities or things like that. We had I'm Easily Impressed pulled out Charizard, Stuck in Reddit Factory Bird pulled out Charmander. Like, Pokemon were a big theme, and that kind of makes sense explicitly. Like, Pokemon, the narrative of Pokemon is that you pick a best friend who you go and fight battles with as like a magical monster. So I mean, like, it's pretty explicitly a child version of the Otherverse, I guess.
Unlike Harry Dubois, this made sense as an answer that came up a lot. I really like Scruza's idea of using the imagery of Pokemon to just kind of accessorize, you know, your others. I think that makes a lot of sense. It does remind me of that custom goblin practice that I spun up that we never ended up using for Pace. And I just think that's because it's a really fun idea. Being like a Pokemon trainer practitioner, I think is a fun vibe if you do it right.
Mm.
To touch on I'm Easily Impressed's answer of Charizard, I specifically want to bring this up because they mentioned that dragons are cool, and in the interest of beating a dead horse, Charizard is not, in fact, a dragon. It's also just an overrated Pokemon. I'm sorry to put you on blast, I'm Easily Impressed, but this goes for Stuck in Reddit Factory too. Charmander and Charizard are overrated, and I've said it to Stuck in Reddit Factory a million times, and I'll say it again. There are so much cool. There's so many cool Pokemon. As if you wouldn't pick Squirtle or Bulbasaur. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'll stop.
What else do we have? Oh, yeah, we had some answers, and I don't know how I felt about these answers. FromSoft games. So we had Shinvi was talking about the Gaping Dragon from Dark Souls, but then also a kind of invader phantom from a player on a laggy connection, which gives them kind of rubber banding abilities, which was hectic. Yeah. Phalanx also talked about Melania from Elden Ring. I feel like FromSoft bosses would be very worrying to pick.
Yeah. These are people who are out for blood.
Like... You'd be fucked. I mean, like, it's a real, like, I'm taking you all down with me kind of vibe.
The laggy connection one is actually really fun. Like, I could totally see that being someone they scrap with in this story, like a technomancy other who has lag, so they're like the timing is weird and they don't really obey physics properly. Like, that feels like the kind of weird mindfucky two chapter villain that Wildbow would throw in one of these stories, so I really see that. Melania, so I never made it that far in Elden Ring. I never saw her, but based on my impression from the internet, I am led to assume that she's basically a Guillemet type. So that does feel like a pretty good answer, because just like an incredibly powerful swordsman vibe. I mean, you're going to fuck shit up with that.
Yeah, definitely. And there's like, it's like, you know, there's like a plague, right? Like a scarlet rot plague in Elden Ring that I think is relevant here. I don't know. It's a real, it's dangerous shit, I think.
Yeah,
for sure.
So this is the problem with getting a FromSoft thing, is you don't quite know what you're getting, because all their lore, it doesn't make sense and the game doesn't tell it to you properly.
Yeah, exactly. The games are terrible, and so therefore you'd get a terrible other. Is that what you're saying, Elliot?
No, I'm saying you get one that doesn't make sense.
Oh, I see. Okay. So yeah, Vice Versailles had an answer that I liked. Stella and Daffodil from Spiritfarer, which is a kind of cute indie game. It was a very practical pick. The reasoning behind it was basically they travel around a lot, and so I would get free international travel on a nice boat. Which is, I mean, you know, fair enough. Good enough reason for me.
Yeah, like... the complete opposite of the people picking Dark Souls bosses. Like, I just want friendly people who will take me around places. And Fukuyobushi-ish, that's how you pronounce that, picked Sonic the Hedgehog. Just, you know, because it seems fun.
Why not?
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand why you wouldn't summon Shadow the Hedgehog, who's the cooler hedgehog.
Yeah, he's way cooler. Or my original character, Ruben the Hedgehog, who's great.
your Sonic OC. Yeah. No, I've only played like 3 Sonic games, but the best one that I've played was the Shadow the Hedgehog game, and he was so cool. And I know he's like super edgelordy, but 14-year-old Elliot thought that was really cool, and I'd want Shadow the Hedgehog to be my friend.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Get yourself an edgelord hedgehog who's going to, you know, shoot people.
Yeah, Edgy the Hedgy. I like the answer from Captain Rhino, who said the smoker from Left 4 Dead, which I think was a really cool pick. Had a great other that you would summon for a fight because they've got a weird and unique gimmick, which is that they have a long tongue that they use to ensnare you. But if you listen closely, you can hear them coughing, and so you might know that they're around. So they kind of feel very other-esque in a very fun way. So I thought that was a great answer from Captain Rhino.
Speaking of characters that I don't understand from games that I haven't played, we also did get Fortune from Metal Gear Solid 2 by Hobo Demon, who bullets miss her, apparently. It felt war dog-esque, which I see you've written as well.
Yes, I did. Good to pick against a war dog as well if bullets miss her. I also haven't played this game, so I don't know. Elliot, what's your answer? How about that?
Also, before we get into our answers, I do want to call out Lurking Belugas well. Because they picked a puddle of slime from Slime Ranchers, which I think is just one of those like Stardew Valley-esque games where you just have a little monster farm. Mm. Like I get the vibe that these puddle slimes are basically just like friendly little choo-choos from Zelda. So a vibe with this answer of just like, you know, Lurking Beluga's not aiming for too much. They don't think they've got the juice to summon some evil god that's going to be powerful. They just want a little slime friend. Mm. And I rate that.
Yeah, fair enough. Then who's your answer, Elliot?
I wanted to say Pikmin at first. I'd love a little army of Pikmin. But I think Yoshi, I've decided, is the best answer. Because I think you get that strong recognition that other people talked about, which is probably important. And then also, Yoshi does so many things. Like, you can ride them around. They'll eat things for you to get rid of them. Also, Yoshi has a driver's license from Mario Kart, so they can drive me places. They can play golf with me. Yoshi does babysitting in some of the games. They're not very good in Smash, so I don't expect they'd be a great fighter, but they can fight. Like, you know, Yoshi's in all these Mario games. They do everything. Yeah. So much versatility out of Yoshi.
Yeah, I feel like Yoshi would be a good familiar for sure. Very versatile.
Yes, Yoshi does commit tax fraud as well. That's canon.
Thank you everyone for leaving your discussion question answers. We have a new discussion question, Elliot.
Yes. So speaking of Verona's evil plan to unseat the great Charles, we're thinking if you're trying to replace the current Ontario judge setup, what would you replace it with? I think like go as big or small as you want with this one. Like, you know, I don't know if Verona's planning to replace all 4 judges with 4 similar-ish judges, if she's going to replace it with a 10-judge system, like, you know, answerer's choice of what you think. If we're going to get 4 different ones, wild. 10 different ones. Yeah. Just one super judge. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Leave your answers to that in our discussion thread, which you can find linked in the show notes down below.
Don't forget to check out our Twitter at Pale Reflect Cast. We post memes there sometimes.
Yes, we do, every single day. A new meme every day. So check in, follow along, and have a good time. Speaking of checking in and following along, another place you can do that is on the Doof Media website. doofmedia.com. You can find all the information about all the shows on the Doof Media Network there, a calendar, all kinds of great things.
Yep, don't forget to stop by our Patreon as well, patreon.com/doofmedia. That's how we afford to do this show.
And while you're on Patreon, make sure you check out Wildbow's Patreon at patreon.com/wildbow, because you should support Wildbow for making this story, and then he'll give us more horrific nightmares of Lucy.
That's what's so funny is Alpi didn't even seem to be involved in that nightmare. I think that's what's funny.
That was a Lucy original.
One of the most painful nightmares in the story, and it wasn't even seemingly a magical one.
Yeah.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.